welcome to the House of Commons. This is a regular podcast about politics. I'm Mark Thompson. I'm a political blogger and commentator. And every week we get a guest on from the world of politics and or journalism to discuss the two or three biggest political topics of the week. And I'm delighted to be joined by Karen Lindsay, who is editor of Lib Dem Voice. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, it's great to be on.
Great to have you back. The first thing we wanted to talk about, and we cannot avoid, is the debate. I'm going to put the word debate in quotes, though, because
Indeed. It
wasn't really a debate, was it? It was two separate sets of interviews with David Cameron first, and then Ed Miliband, and it was on Channel 4 and Sky News, and it was Paxman and Kay Burley. So Paxman did the actual interrogation of both of them, and then Kay Burley chaired a sort of audience Q&A with each of them. And the order was slightly strange as well, in that Cameron was interviewed by Paxman first, then he got grilled by the audience, then Ed Miliband came in and was grilled by the audience, and then finally Ed Miliband was grilled by Paxman. So it was all a bit strange. And we were just talking about it before we started recording, and Karen, you said that's 90 minutes of your life you're not going to get back, and I sort of feel a bit the same as well. What did you think of it overall? Do you think we learned anything? Do you think it was an edifying display by both of them, either of them?
I think all it really confirmed, really, is that Ed Miliband, actually, in the end of the day, is quite a nice guy, but he's very intense about policy, but he can't communicate it. He's really not very good at that. Whereas David Cameron just confirmed everything we ever thought about him, everything that he's going to do if he gets power on his own that the Liberal Democrats have stopped him doing for the last 5 years. He'll slash welfare.
But he won't tell us like where those slashes are going to come. He's just going to do it, and he's just going to obfuscate until after the election, which seems very anti-democratic to me.
Well, indeed, and some of his plans have been leaked, were on the BBC this morning about cutting carers and disabled benefits and things like that. It's just appalling. Mm. I'm quite keen for some of the welfare budget to be cut, but I think it's things like, for my house, getting the winter fuel allowance. We don't need it. It's ridiculous. But, you know, when my husband is working, we're both working and getting, you know, a reasonable income, we just don't need it.
Yeah, but I mean, I've talked about this before on this podcast. I mean, that's classic pork barrel politics, isn't it? Because, you know, Cameron is protecting that stuff because old people vote.
Yeah, and that's, you could see him reaching out to the elderly audience, people like my parents. I just felt the whole debate, I was so unbalanced as well. Kay Burley, I was really disappointed in. Not for the first time, it has to be said. But, I mean, she seriously asked Cameron, have you ever had 3 shredded wheat? And then Ed Miliband was getting, you know, would your brother have done a better job than you? It was not exactly what you would call balance.
I have to say about just a little side about this shredded wheat thing. I was actually, it really started to make me feel old, because I heard Cameron say that when he was interviewed by James Landell the other day. And I immediately got the reference. I remember there were loads of adverts in the 1980s. Shredded wheat, can you have 3 shredded wheat? I remember Ian Botham in one of the adverts. I think Frank Bruno was in another one. It was a well-trodden meme that went on for years. And I saw loads of people on Twitter who didn't get the reference. And I just started to realise that I get that because I'm old.
I have to say, And I have to say, I have never eaten a shredded wheat in my life. I would rather eat a pile of straw.
It's sort of like eating straw.
It's effectively what it is.
You have to have lots of milk and lots of sugar to give it some kind of flavour. You're not missing much.
Yeah, Weetabix all the way for me. But I mean, going back to the debate, I don't think we found out anything that we didn't already know. And I think that's the thing about the dynamics of a debate, a proper debate, where people can bounce off each other. The I agree with Nick thing that came out in 2010. Where that's all Gordon Brown said in the first debate. But there was nothing like that. I mean, obviously, Cameron didn't want to take part in that sort of debate. As the incumbent, he had so much to lose.
Well, I mean, on the previous podcast, I did talk to my guest about that and the fact that, I mean, from my perspective, it does feel like Cameron is the one who bottled it. I mean, I don't really think there's any doubt about that, although you do see some Tory activists who try to claim that that's not true. And I saw Liz Truss being interviewed on Newsnight just after the debate. And she, the line she was spinning was that, no, the whole thing was chaos and Cameron stepped in and produced order from chaos and that this is what the broadcasters wanted. And it's like, that is absolute bollocks. It's obvious what happened here. Cameron didn't want to debate head to head. They were in the same studio. If Cameron, even up to the 5 minutes before broadcast, had said, actually, do you know what? I will debate Ed Miliband head on. I'm sure they'd have managed to grab a lectern from somewhere and do it. Yes. You know, it was him that bottled it. And surely it's obvious to everyone, even people who don't follow politics. Surely.
Well, I would think so. But I don't actually think it matters that much to voters. You know, I think, you know, it was funny. Interesting. I've had a kind of couple of weeks of medical emergencies and not really being able to see the news as I would not consume the news as I would normally. So I consume the news as everybody else does in little snippets as you go by, rather than kind of geeking out on Radio 4 or the BBC News channel. And do you know what? None of this stuff actually resonates, I think. That people don't really pick that stuff. I don't think people really pick up on that stuff, and I don't think they care about it.
Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, I'm probably too ensconced in this to really be able to see the wood for the trees in that respect. I mean, in terms of the actual the things that they said, Ed Miliband seemed to get quite a bit of coverage for his "Am I tough enough to be Prime Minister? Hell yes" speech, which I have to say that the "hell yes" bit actually didn't really do much for me. The stuff where he said about how he stood up to Obama, I think that was a bit more powerful, although I did see Dan Hodges take that apart in the Telegraph yesterday. I should say we're recording this on Saturday afternoon, by the way, just so people know when I'm saying things yesterday or the day before. Sorry, carry on.
If I stood up to the leader of the free world. No, not really, Ed. That's not quite how it was. You kind of agreed that it was okay. And then when the rest of the Labour Party pulled you back, you said, no, I don't agree with that anymore. So I don't think that was quite how it happened.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think, you know, there's quite a lot of spin going on here. But at the same time, the way he came across in terms of the answer and, you know, to go back to the people who don't perhaps pay much attention to politics, which is probably 90-odd% of the population, I think that sort of answer probably came across quite well, because it did seem to show that this idea that he's very weak is not necessarily true, because regardless of his motivations, he did actually effectively prevent a war.
I think that's true, along with the many Liberal Democrat MPs who didn't actually vote for that.
Of course.
It was actually quite interesting that kind of fewer than half of Lib Dem MPs actually supported that when you look at it.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you think this debate's going to have made any difference then to the dynamics of the campaign or the ultimate results? Or do you think it's one of these here today, gone tomorrow things?
I think the heather is as yet unburning, shall we say.
Excellent Scottish reference there.
Indeed.
Okay, so you don't think it's going to have much effect then, because we're still several weeks out from the actual election itself, and there are actually more debates. Perhaps the next one, which is going to have seven people, which is more like a kind of Borgen thing, or like that's a French presidential election type debate. You know, that maybe that'll get more coverage just because that's such a novelty.
I think what's going to be interesting about that, apart from the fact that it's actually taking place on the anniversary of the Clegg versus Farage debate last year. which, you know, it was not a date that many of us really want to remember that much. I think that it's going to be very, very difficult for anyone really to make an impact with seven people. It's going to be very soundbitey. It's going to be very lacking in information. I think the debate of the five and then the kind of question time thing with the three at the end, I think these are the ones that are going to be the most illuminating.
Yeah, I think the question time one, because that's not long before election day and that's got the three main party leaders.
Yeah.
I think that might be the one that sticks the most, because I think they've got half an hour each then as well.
And I'm glad that's the one that Nick Clegg is included in. I mean, I was annoyed that he wasn't included in the one on Thursday night, because he has a record in government to And it was so, what really grated on me was seeing David Cameron take the credit for all of our popular policies.
It's funny, I thought of you when he was answering those questions, actually, because I knew it would be pissing you off. I'm not a Lib Dem anymore, and it was pissing me off. So
yeah. And that's something that I think the party is going to have to be really careful about during the campaign, and really kind of stamp on it. Although I think a lot of the journalists now, a lot of the commentators know fine where these policies came from, and they're calling them out for it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say something else about that. Oh yeah, the order. So that final debate, do we know what the order is going to be? Because that's actually quite crucial, because if Clegg's first or second and Cameron's after him, mm-hmm. then Cameron can say whatever the hell he likes and Clegg won't have any comeback. Whereas if Clegg's last, then yeah. obviously he will get the chance to rebut anything that... Mm-hmm. Actually, the fairest way to do it would be to have them all recorded simultaneously with three different moderators and three different audiences, and then just play them back sequentially so that none of them gets the chance to kind of, you know, rebut anything that anyone else has said, and they just have to plough their own furrow. But I bet that won't happen. I'm guessing it's going to be down to lots again, like this time. It was just toss of a coin, wasn't it?
Although the tactics of whatever, I mean, I think Nick will be trying to get into his remarks, if he's got any sense, that the Tories have been trying to take credit for all the Lib Dem policies, which they have argued so strongly against and had to be dragged kicking and screaming to giving the each raising of the tax threshold came with gnashing and wailing of teeth, or the other way around, or whatever that is, between Danny Alexander and George Osborne. There was an almighty row about it every time, and the Lib Dems won every time.
There was one other thing I just wanted to say about these debates before we moved on, and I really, really liked seeing it. It's the first time I've ever seen it done, which is this really annoying tick that all modern politicians seem to do it now. I first remember seeing Blair do it, and all of them seem to have picked up on it now. But Ed Miliband is particularly egregious at this, and that is they're asked a question, and then their response is, well, if you're asking me such and such, then the answer is such and such. And Paxman picked him up on that twice during his questioning. He actually said, you've asked your own question and you're answering your own question. That's not what I asked you. What I asked you was such and such. And then about a minute later, he did exactly the same thing. And Paxman said, you're doing it again. And I was really pleased to see that, because that just drives me nuts. Like, it's such an obvious thing. And they all do it, and they so often get away with it as well. So it was nice to see a politician getting picked up on it. Although that was probably the low point
well.
For
him. I mean, there are other ways. There are much more subtle ways of not answering a question and getting out the. I mean, because every politician goes into an interview with certain things that they want to get out, and they will manipulate the questions to enable them to do so. But there are more subtle ways of doing it.
Yeah, it's a bit sledgehammery. And I think that slightly sums up Ed Miliband's approach sometimes, in that, you know, I think he's a little bit too wonky. I think you alluded to this at the start, which is strange, really, because against his brother, he was the one that was described as, you know, Ed does human, whereas David Miliband doesn't do human. So he was supposed to be the one who wasn't like a robot, you know, an I speak your policy robot. And yet that's not really how it's played out.
Actually, I think between the two of them, between David and Ed, Ed is the one I'd probably rather want to have a conversation with. I always felt that David was kind of speaking down to us all, and he was far too Blairite. Ed did seem, and I think he actually is quite a nice guy.
Cameron,
to be honest.
That I've heard that a lot, that in person he's very personable and all the rest of it. But you know who I used to hear that about all the time? Gordon Brown. So it doesn't really cut any ice with me. And I always used to hear, oh, Gordon, he can work a room and he's so good face-to-face, one-on-one. It's like, well, yeah, well, if you can meet 60 million voters, then fine. But
actually, Scott, I think maybe my experience of Scottish politics is, Gordon Brown is actually quite a decent human being as well. He's maybe a little mercurial, but he is quite personable.
Excellent word, mercurial. Okay, good stuff. Right, let's move on from that. And there'll be other debates that I'm sure I'll be talking about in future episodes, but that's part of that for now. And next thing I wanted to talk about, I want to take advantage of the fact that you're on, Karen, to talk about Scottish politics, which obviously is something you know a lot about, and I don't know that much about, because I'm not Scottish and I don't live in Scotland. But the way things have panned out in Scotland over the last few months, from the perspective of someone looking at it from the outside, has seemed quite remarkable in that there was obviously the independence referendum last year, last September, and the run-up to it, as well as things got more and more intense. And the yes side, led by the SNP, lost. So 45% of people voted yes, but 55% voted no. And I guess the conventional wisdom was that once that outcome, which was the predicted outcome, that the yes would lose and no would win, that you know the SNP would kind of collapse into bitter internal recriminations and the idea of independence would be off the agenda for a generation. Almost the exact opposite has happened. The SNP has never been more united. The membership has tripled, quadrupled, quintupled. It's gone up many, many fold, to the point where Nicola Sturgeon, who's now the SNP leader, having taken over from Alex Salmond, was able to fill a stadium with people with a personal appearance, which is just, it couldn't possibly happen in this country, in England, with English politicians. It's almost like kind of rock star quality. And far from the people who want independence collapsing into bitter recriminations, it's now looking like the SNP are almost going to sweep the board in Scotland. There's 59 seats up for grabs in the Westminster elections in a few weeks. And there are polls that are talking about them getting 50, 53. Even the worst case scenario has got them on 35, 40, which considering they've got six at the moment is incredible. And most of those are going to come from Labour and a few probably from the Lib Dems. And from where you're sitting, Karen, did you see this coming?
I think that this is not something that's just happened in the last sort of couple of years since we've had the referendum. I mean, this has been building for a long, long time, probably since kind of Iraq war time. The Scottish people have been wanting to give the Labour Party a good kicking for a very, very long time. But the way the electoral system worked didn't allow them to do that. I think having the Holyrood Parliament, and actually, I mean, the first 8 years of that, Labour were in government with Lib Dems and actually had quite a good record. But I think people just wanted change. You know, post the Iraq War, the SNP got in a minority government and actually governed reasonably competently. It's only sort of in the second term when they got an overall majority, which was contributed to by, you know, the Labour Party just being, you know, not having anything interesting to say. We had our own problems with the coalition. So they got the SNP got an overall majority and decided, you know, obviously, to have a referendum on independence. It's been a very strange time. That referendum was, having lived through it, actually was probably one of the most emotionally draining, difficult things I've ever gone through in politics. It was incredibly divisive. It was nasty out there. Real kind of, when there were accounts, I was coming home on the train 2 days before the referendum. I had my wee better together anorak on. And somebody came up to me and said, you know, they're English. They were sitting in a pub and this yes campaigner had just come over and started abusing them and haranguing them and said, you know, that they were, you know, they were traitors if they were voting no and that kind of stuff. And, you know, that sort of attitude is still prevalent. I mean, my friend was walking down the street in one of Scotland's towns last Saturday, saw the SNP, refused a leaflet from them perfectly politely and was called a traitor behind his back. It's not all the kind of happy, kind of wonderful sort of dance towards independence that the SNP would have you believe. But what's interesting is what we're getting at the moment is between the similarity between what Alex Salmond is saying and what the Conservatives are saying. The Conservatives really want to play up this idea that Alex Salmond is going to control all of our politics if he gets the balance of power. Why are they trying to do that? To make people vote Conservative. Why is Alex Salmond doing that? To make England vote Conservative, because he sees, the SNP see, the best chance of independence is a majority Tory government, preferably with a bit of UKIP support in England.
Well, there's another very strange thing going on in England. I mean, maybe, you know, the more cynical amongst the listeners will think that it's not that strange. But the Conservative Party, which I don't know if this still is officially in their title. They certainly used to be known as the Conservative and Unionist Party.
Yeah.
They, you know, of all the parties, were probably the most vociferous about the union for kind of historical reasons. And although David Cameron slightly fought shy of leading the campaign for No, he certainly popped up and made a few speeches, and it was very, very clear what his feelings about it were and are. But what he's now doing and what he's now saying, all these posters with Alex Salmond, with Ed Miliband in his top pocket, and this idea that, you know, it's absolutely terrible that the SNP think that they might be able to you know, have the balance of power and might be able to decide who the government is going to be. You know, the Yes campaign only need 5% next time. And what Cameron is doing is gifting them that 5% by making it clear that the Conservatives don't think that Scotland should have any say in how the United Kingdom government is run.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that Vince Cable came up here and kind of made some comments in the press that actually, yes, we could work with the SNP, which wasn't dreadfully helpful, because if the Liberal Democrat message is that we're the only ones who can stop the SNP, that kind of had that kind of message wasn't dreadfully consistent. So it actually meant that Willie Rennie had to come out and kind of almost explicitly, not quite explicitly, but make comments that sounded like we wouldn't work with the SNP. But realistically, if we're in a situation where the arithmetic means that you have to, you're just going to have to get on with it. And actually, there's a limit to the damage that they can actually do, I think. They're not going to break apart the union. They'll try and cause a lot of trouble. But I think that in terms of their value, if they're going to be true to their values as a party, which is supposed to be about equality and social justice, then they can't really cause that much bother, I don't think.
And Nicola Sturgeon certainly seems to be a more nuanced and more subtle politician than Alex Salmond. She seems to be more consensual in that respect. I mean, she won't actually be the one leading the troops in Westminster. It will possibly be Alex Salmond, although it's not guaranteed he's going to win the seat he's trying to fight. But looking at the polls, probably more likely than not.
Actually, he's just cancelled a book tour. He wrote this book, The Dream Will Never Die, which Paddy Ashdown described as the greatest work of literary masturbation since politics began. he was going to disappear off to the States a week on Monday to do some book signings and stuff in New York, and he was going to Canada as well. And he's had to cancel that now.
Because his seat's tighter than he thought.
Because his seat, because he's realising he's actually got a really good fight in his hands.
Hmm.
Yeah. And actually, Christine Jardine, who's our candidate there, she has been working very, very hard for 2 years now, and you know, is very, very well known, and gave him a good trouncing at the first big hustings on Thursday night. So he is not going to. This is not going his way at the moment.
Interesting. I mean, obviously, the received wisdom seems to be that, you know, he will, by hook or by crook, get back in, and he wouldn't have chosen the seat if he wasn't very sure that he was going to win it. But strange things have happened, I suppose. But one way or another, it's certainly not going to be Nicola Sturgeon in Westminster. It will either be Salmond or it will be, I'm not sure who else it would be, actually.
Well, Angus Robertson is the current leader of the SNP MPs.
Yeah.
And also their deputy leader is Stuart Hosey. So, but I don't think anybody can really imagine Alex Salmond sitting meekly on the back benches behind either of those two.
Well, no, if Salmond ends up back in Westminster, then yeah, I'm sure he will somehow emerge.
Westminster, this place he says he hates. Yeah.
Well, but he was a creature of Westminster for so many years, wasn't he? And he was actually very good at it. I mean, I don't really like Alex Salmond anymore after last year, but I did used to like him, and he was always very good value on things like Any Questions and Question Time. He always came across to me as a non-Scot, as a kind of likeable, clubbable chap. I thought some of the stuff he pulled last year really, really put me off him. But I could certainly imagine that they'll want to make the most of him if he does end up back in Westminster. I'm not sure if there's anything much more to say about this, because obviously we'll have to wait and see what happens.
But I don't think they're actually going to win as many seats as they think they're going to win.
But if they do win, let's say, more seats than the Lib Dems, so therefore they're the third biggest party in Parliament, then there is a democratic legitimacy to them either providing confidence and supply or even going into a coalition with another party, isn't there? I mean, it's not right to just say, no, they can't do that. And they're entitled to, aren't they?
I think, I mean, this is the problem I had with kind of ruling out coalition deals with them. Actually, the heat needs to be on them, not on whether other people would exclude them, because that just kind of plays to their the victim status that they like to portray. Actually, it's up to them. Would they put the Tories in power, or would they stop it happening? I think we need to look at it that way, rather than other people ruling them out. But they don't want to be in coalition with anybody. I think that's the bottom line. All they want is to pursue the path that is most likely to give them independence.
Yeah, and there is one other thing I want to say on this, actually. Which is an old hobby horse of mine, as you know, Karen, which is that if the SNP get 90% or 85% of the seats in Scotland on 45% of the vote, then it could ultimately be the first-past-the-post system that causes the breakup of the union. So all of this stuff about it's a stable voting system and it's what we've had for hundreds of years and it guarantees stable government is shown to be an absolute load of bollocks.
Absolutely. But I don't think they will. I think there will be quite a lot of tactical voting. I certainly think that will, you know, and I think in our seats as well, because we have been working really, really hard for such a long time, I think, and people know our MPs very well. I think that we'll kind of be insulated a bit from them. But I think that the Labour Party, that I think what was laid very clear during the referendum is that, you know, the places where they used to get sort of their majorities in, you know, tens of thousands, they don't have any campaigning infrastructure there at all. They didn't have, on polling day in the referendum, they just didn't have any bodies in these places to actually do stuff.
Yeah.
And that is just unbelievable.
It's kind of not unbelievable. I mean, again, I'm going to bang on about my hobby horse here, and I know you agree with me about this, so this might be quite boring for people who don't agree with us, but that's, again, a legacy of first past the post, because if you've got a safe seat, where's the incentive to build up the local membership and, you know, keep the canvassing and know where your vote is? If you weigh in your vote on election night, what's the point? You might as well not bother. But that then leads to this situation where the on-the-ground operation atrophies over time until it's kind of non-existent. And then, you know, it doesn't take that much for a well-organised opposition party to sweep in and suddenly everything can change. I remember quite vividly, actually, when David Miliband stood down from Parliament a couple of years ago. I remember a piece on Labour List by Mark Ferguson where he was bemoaning how terrible the ground operation was in Miliband's seat. Well, you know, David Miliband didn't really care about the ground operation because he was a Blair advisor, and then he was parachuted into a safe seat, and it was supposed to be a seat for life. And he obviously expected at some point to, you know, maybe be prime minister or at least leader of his party. So he didn't care about any of that stuff. So it kind of felt like on Labour List they were asking for the wrong thing or talking about it from the wrong perspective, because, you know, there are dozens, probably hundreds of Labour seats like that around the country. And it's because of the electoral system. The electoral system allows MPs to become lazy. Don't get me wrong, lots of MPs are not lazy, and even lots of MPs in safe seats are not lazy. But there are some who are, and the system allows them to be like that and allows the situation to happen. So perhaps we shouldn't be so surprised that a well-organised machine like the SNP, that's obviously been sitting on the sidelines a little bit, waiting for a moment like this, is able to sweep in And the kind of majorities that you would just assume are safe are looking like they could easily be swept away.
Well, I mean, and that's exactly it. And you can see that they're worried because for the first time in 15 years, Labour came and knocked on my doorstep a few weeks ago. And the look of kind of amazement and contempt that came across the guy's face when I told him that I was voting Liberal Democrat, it was like he'd never seen one before. It was really quite funny. But you know what's interesting is that all when Labour canvass, all they're bothered about is whether or not you're voting for them. You're either for them or against them. They're not bothered about who you're voting for. Now, you would think in an election like this, that they would be writing to all the people who tell them they're voting at Tory or Lib Dem, saying, you know, we've got to lend us your vote this time so that we can defeat the S to keep the SNP out. I wouldn't respond to that personally because I just couldn't vote anything other than Liberal Democrat. But other people might, and that's something that Labour, I think, if they don't learn to do that, in quite a lot of seats across Scotland, they could find themselves in trouble.
Well, we'll know in just under 6 weeks' time.
I
It's
know.
going to be fascinating. Probably the most fascinating part of the election is going to be what happens in Scotland, because if it is what the polls seem to be suggesting, then that is revolutionary, isn't it, in your part of the country.
I don't think the SNP themselves expect to win more than about 25 seats, actually. And which would be sort of four times what they've got already. But I think they'll find that ours are much more difficult to win. The closely fought Labour ones will be more difficult to win. But they could win quite a lot of the ones where there's just no Labour infrastructure at all.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our final topic now, which is there was an aeroplane crash in the south of France a few days ago. I think the airline's Germanwings, part of Lufthansa. And it was unclear what had happened at first. There was questions over whether the cabin had depressurized, but the trajectory of the plane made it look like it had been a controlled descent and was a controlled descent to deliberately crash the plane. What has subsequently transpired is that it's become clear that the pilot left the cockpit and the co-pilot then locked the pilot out, and then the co-pilot deliberately crashed the plane and didn't respond to any of the knocking or shouting or banging as the pilot tried to get back into the cockpit. There are also suggestions that the co-pilot was suffering from depression. I don't know if any of this has been actually officially confirmed yet, but there's been lots of speculation about it, and it would seem, I think, likely that there is something to these rumours. And he was, I think, he was getting some treatment, and he had seen medical professionals about it over the course of months and years. But since then, there's been all kinds of coverage, especially in the tabloid press. I mean, I don't read the Mail, but I happened to see a screenshot of it via Twitter, where the headline was something like, "How could they have allowed him to fly the plane when he had a history of depression?"
I know.
And there's been lots of coverage like that. And I know that you wrote a piece about this on Lib Dem Voice yesterday, Karen, where you said that, you know, we have a long way to go in terms of the stigma that's attached to mental illness. I mean, what are your thoughts about this?
I think my biggest worry, I mean, it was a horrible, horrible tragedy. You know, you just feel for everybody who's lost somebody in that. I'd say that first of all. But there are an awful lot of people who are, I think, going to be in more danger as a result of these horrendously insensitive, inaccurate newspaper headlines. I mean, you know, they using words like crazed and, you know, stuff like that. It's scapegoating, stigmatizing people with mental ill health with absolutely no basis and evidence to back that up. I mean, Churchill suffered from depression and he ran the country through, you know, the Second World War. And this idea that there should be some, you know, there should be jobs that people with depression shouldn't be allowed to do, as the headlines were screaming, just awful. But I think it was good that Mind actually put out a statement kind of saying thing, you know, just basically said that, you know, there can be pilots with experience in depression who have flown safely for decades. And the headlines risk adding to the stigma surrounding mental health problems. And that might mean that people who are suffering from mental health problems, who are too scared to say because they're worried about the stigma, are even become even more reluctant to seek help. And their conditions get worse.
Well, that's
gets worse.
That's exactly the point, isn't it? Because there is a stigma attached to mental illness. And I mean, I think one of the biggest problems is this kind of, I suppose I'd describe it as like a spiral of silence that you have around mental illness, where if you've got someone who hasn't suffered any mental problems themselves personally, they probably think that mental illness is a very uncommon thing. Although, ironically, they probably know several people in their own personal lives who have suffered or are suffering from psychological problems. But because it's not talked about, they may not even be aware of that. In fact, they're probably statistically not aware of that. And so therefore, it seems other to them. I think I tweeted something yesterday where I said that this is the biggest problem with the stigma attached to mental illness, that people think that it makes, you know, the sufferer other, in quotes, almost as if they're not quite human, as if they're different. They can be put into a category of, you know, well, that person's mentally ill. I remember a number of years ago, Frank Bruno was suffering from some kind of psychological problems, and the Sun's headline was "Bonkers Bruno," something or other. And there was a massive public backlash against that, and they actually apologised for it. But what the last few days has demonstrated is that the tabloid press actually have learned nothing, and they don't give a shit about the reality of this sort of situation. Yeah. They pander to the lowest common denominator, and they obviously think that they can get away with this, and that it's going to sell papers, which is actually a pretty sad reflection and indictment upon at least a section of our population, isn't it?
I mean, it is. And that's why I think that the work that, you know, Norman Lamb and Nick Clegg have been doing in government to try and tackle the stigma has been really, really good.
They must be tearing their hair out about this situation, though.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they are. But I mean, last month, for example, they had this Time to Talk Day. They've had it for a couple of years now, sort of first Thursday in February, where they just have people sharing their own experiences of mental ill health. And Lib Dem Voice has actually taken part in that the last 2 years. And we have had some stunning posts where people have shared their own experiences and said what it's like. It was a wonderful article, actually, in last year's one by somebody who had suffered from bipolar disorder for many years and how that affected her. And I just think it's all the more important. I mean, I have suffered from depression on and off throughout my life, and anxiety as well. And, you know, and I think it's quite important that we should continue to be open about that. And, you know, because the only way to combat the kind of demonizing and the stigma is to actually explain what it's like. I mean, I have, you know, suffered. Most people who suffer from mental illness never harm anybody. They're more likely to harm themselves, and they're more likely to be victims of crime than to actually perpetrate them. And that, you know, that's what we need to be saying, and saying it loud all the time.
There's another aspect to this, though, which makes it more difficult. If you're diagnosed with cancer and you tell someone, they're unlikely to say or secretly think, well, that's sort of your own fault, isn't it? I mean, I suppose maybe if you're a chain smoker 80 a day and you've got lung cancer, maybe, but, you know, usually they're going to think, well, that's really unfortunate, and feel very, very sorry for you, and it's just one of those things, and, you know, hope you get better. Whereas if you tell someone you've got depression or you've got psychological problems, I think there's quite a significant proportion of the population in this country that would think, well, what have you done to cause that? Then that must be your fault somehow. What have you done? What, you know, why are you like that? You know, and so there isn't an equivalence between physical illness and mental illness. And I think until we can break that, until you know, the vast majority of people in this country accept that, you know, mental illness can happen to anyone at any time, and it's not your fault. Until we can break that cycle, I think it's always going to be an uphill struggle, unfortunately.
I know. We had this amazing debate at Lib Dem conference, Scottish Lib Dem conference a couple of years ago, where I mean, a lot of young people really were sharing their own experiences. It's the most incredible debate I've ever been involved in, because there was real kind of emotion in the room. And it was funny because the next item on the agenda was Vince Cable's speech. So at the end of the debate, lots of people were coming in to listen to that. Half the room was in tears. The other half was just kind of in shock. It's kind of the stuff that they'd been hearing. But I think that did an awful lot to actually promote the understanding amongst those other people who were coming in. And it was described in the press as a really amazing debate. And Willie Rennie actually referred to it again in his leader's speech last weekend, as a kind of almost a turning point in the party's thinking, the party's understanding. It's really kind of embraced mental health in a big way. I mean, Nick, there's something that Nick Clegg has always, that's what he came into politics to do. One of the things was in mental health, and the other thing was to improve life chances for disadvantaged kids. And I think he's really brought the party with him on that.
Do you think it's getting better? I mean, I don't just mean in the Lib Dems. I think, you know, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, the Lib Dems have seized the mantle on this in recent times. But it, more generally in the population and perhaps in our kind of body politic as well, do you think it is getting better slowly, perhaps incrementally? Obviously, we're not where we want to be yet, but do you think it is improving?
A little bit. But I think that there's so much more to do. And you know, it's very clear from these horrible headlines of the last couple of days how much there is to do. But I do think it's getting better. You can't turn an oil tanker of the horrible stigma around overnight. I mean, it's going to take years of sustained effort.
Mm. Which is quite depressing, but at the same time, I suppose it's just a reflection of reality, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's something we just we've got to. It shows that we've got to work sort of five times harder than we are. And it's one of the reasons why we really need Norman Lamb staying in post for the next 5 years.
Mm. We never know. He might be leader soon. Some of the speculation that I've seen, which actually I know we didn't actually have this as a specific topic, but just in the last minute or two. What do you think is going to happen with the Lib Dems at the election? How many seats do you think the Lib Dems are going to win?
I'm not going to put a number on it because I'm so close to a lot of the people who are actually fighting, and I think we've all got a good chance. And I just don't want to put a number on it because it means kind of dismissing some of those people. I think we're going to do a lot better than people think. I don't think there's going to be a wipeout. I think that on the ground where we have the best campaigning operation that we have ever had, I think that we will really make a difference in those seats. I just think it's a pity that we're having to confine ourselves to those kind of 60 odd seats where we think we can win, because what worries me more is what's going to happen in the areas where we have maybe had councillors before, we've had really strong, you know, reasonably strong local parties. And we're going to end up maybe getting, you know, maybe not even keeping our deposits. That's what kind of worries me more.
Well, that's very bad news for the long term, because the way you build up parliamentary strength is by, you know, fighting a seat and perhaps coming a distant third and then fighting harder and then doing a better third. And then the next time round you come second, and then you can start to put out the famous bar charts with the, you know, it's a two horse race, and you can start squeezing the votes of the people in third and fourth and fifth place. And eventually, you know, it's what Lib Dem campaigners have done down the generations. Eventually you can become an MP. And I think the long term problem with what is likely to happen at this election is that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of seats will be almost the clock will be reset to almost nothing, and it will be a job to start that could take decades to claw back from that position. But in terms of what's likely to happen in a few weeks' time, I understand your reticence to put a number on it. I understand that completely, but the confidence that you have, or the gut feeling that you have that the party's going to do better, Does it not worry you when you look at what happened at the European elections last year, that the party went from having 12 or 13 MEPs to one? Catherine Bearder in the southeast, who I voted for, I lived in the southeast at that point, and even then it was only by a few thousand. It was pretty close to complete wipeout. And before that election, I remember a lot of Lib Dems saying it won't be as bad as it seems. We'll hold on to a few MEPs, you know, perhaps several, and actually you nearly lost all of them. Is that not a marker for perhaps a bit more pessimism here rather than optimism?
That was all. But the thing is, if I had thought, been asked 5 years ago, what's going to be the worst day of the next 5 years, that polling day for that European election would have been it. We never do well in European elections. And in this one, we were kind of completely pushed out. I think now, when we are fighting on our record in government, when we can tell people, actually, we've done loads of stuff on mental health, we've done loads of stuff for disadvantaged kids in school, we've extended childcare, we've introduced shared parental leave, we have cut your tax, your income tax bill, if you are on a lower or a middle income. And these are all the things that we said we were going to do. I think if we can get that message across, and we have been doing, I mean, when you talk to voters in our key seats, they are getting that message through, and they are, you know, happy to vote for us. So I think we'll do a lot better. And I don't want to put a number in. I think we'll do better in Scotland, because I think we've got our campaigning infrastructure there and has been for, you know, several years now. I mean, I've been part of the kind of the Dragon's Den process, if you like, in Scotland. I've seen how much things have improved over the last 3 years. I think that, you know, I reckon we are going to be key players in the next parliament.
Okay. Well, that's an optimistic note to end things on then. Obviously, I used to be a member of the Lib Dems, and I'm still a fellow traveller on a lot of issues. And although I'm not happy with some of what the party's done in government, I think they get a pretty bad rap. And I think it is disproportionate, you know, the amount of vitriol that's poured on them compared to probably what they deserve, considering what the party has managed to achieve. At the same time, you came up with a big long list of all the good stuff that's done, but there is an equally long list of stuff that, you know, the party has allowed the Conservatives to do. And that would obviously be what your opponents would list, just for a bit of balance. I won't list them, but you know what they are.
And there is also that wonderful Daily Mail headline from a couple of years ago that basically David Cameron gave an interview, basically said, I'd govern like a proper Tory if it wasn't for those Lib Dems.
That is true.
I think we'll be seeing a lot of that in the next few weeks.
It's difficult to fight a campaign, though, on what could have happened, isn't it? That's the problem, fighting a campaign on hypotheticals. But good luck anyway.
Okay, thank you.
And it's been great to have you back on. And maybe after the election, we can have another chat. And obviously, at that point, we'll know what's happened and see how the land lies at that point, both in terms of Scotland and also in terms of the country in general and the Lib Dems, perhaps in particular.
That would be great. Nice to talk to you, Mark.
All right. Thanks, Karen. And I'd just like to thank Audio Boom, who very kindly host the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back soon.